Talking History. This is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History with me, Patrick Gagan. A new book offers an historic overview of the three major areas of the alcohol industry: brewing, distilling, and wine, drawing on accounting records from the sector to reveal fresh and unique insights into the historic development of the production of alcoholic beverages. The book is called Accounting for Alcohol, an accounting history of brewing, distilling, and viniculture. It's published in hardback by Routledge, and the editors are Martin Quinn and João Oliveira. And I'm delighted to be joined in the studio by Martin Quinn and two of the contributors, Peter Cleary and Desmond Gibney. You're all very welcome.
Thank you.
Martin, I'll begin with you. Tell me, first of all, how did you get the idea to put together this collection of essays?
Well, I've done some work on the accounting history of Guinness from the archives down in James's Gate. And as an academic, I was reading some articles, and there was a call for papers on accounting and military history, because war is quite prevalent throughout the centuries and even millennia. And I thought, well, alcohol is also quite prevalent in society. So that was the initial idea. And then I met some editors from Routledge who I knew in a pub. Good place to start the idea. And I suppose the end of that conversation was, alcohol is much more interesting than military history.
And it's interesting because through the prism of accounting, you're able to get a very interesting insight into the breweries, the wineries, and the distilleries.
Yeah, I suppose we all think of accounting as really boring, and accountants are grey-suited, dreary old men. But a set of financial statements has a lot more than just numbers. And as you're looking at the archival records, you can see so much more about how accounting, accounting reflects the business transactions, and the business transactions reflect the society of the time. So, we can see things that are really, really high level from just looking at a set of accounts and the numbers around them. And to give you an example, in one of the chapters in Guinness, there was introduction to new technology in the late 1920s, and the technology was typewriters that could add, and which was big probably back then. But the end result of that introduction of technology is the same kind of effect as you would have today: job losses.
Very interesting. And it's interesting that the accountancy practices are still recognisable today, because there hasn't been the changes and the shifts that you might have expected.
Yeah, I suppose the basics of accounting haven't changed for a long, long time. And I think the oldest record we have in the books is from a monastery in Spain. And I think it's a statement from 1338, if memory serves me correctly. And it's recognisable to us today as accountants.
It also is used to help control the production of the different types of alcohol, whether it's vodka or beer or wine or rum or whatever.
Yeah.
So accountancy, in a way, helps control the entire brewing industry.
It does indeed. And I suppose when we think of accounting, we think we're only accounting for money, but we can account for anything. And you mentioned accounting for beer and something. One of the chapters gives a great example of the allowance of beer on HMS Victory, which was Nelson's ship. A gallon of beer a day for each sailor, or a pint of wine if there was no beer available. And I think the ship could hold 50 tons of beer per voyage, which was a very large amount of beer, I guess. And accounting, obviously, we can see there was control of the vodka production through the Russian state and private sector before the Soviet state. And even in Franco's time in Spain, the cooperative wineries were controlled as well through accounting numbers.
Peter, let's continue on that theme, because your work shows that British legislation and taxes helped shape the whiskey production in Ireland during the period of British rule.
That's right, Patrick. Specifically, I looked at the Watercourse Distillery in Cork, which is in Blackpool on the north of Cork City. But during the period of their existence and prior to that, the British government have had a big influence on the whiskey production. And specifically, the British government saw it as a means of raising taxes and raising revenue for themselves. So as an example, in 1779, they introduced the Distilling Act, which placed a big levy on the use of pot stills to produce whiskey, or to distill whiskey, which would have been prevalent in Ireland at that time. And obviously the main reason was to raise revenue and raise income. But the result of that was the number of Irish distillers actually reduced significantly because of the significant levies being placed on them. Other legislation that the British passed, for example, in 1817, they also passed a law which in an attempt to protect the British distilling industry, that no raw spirits could be received by any British-based distiller unless they were rectified. And what that meant is that Irish whiskey was unable to be exported to the UK to be drunk as whiskey. It had to be used as part of the production process to produce British brandy or British whiskey.
And in a way, your story is also the story of the development of Cork and the role of Cork's merchant princes. And to do what they were doing, they needed good information, good accounts. And that's where all of this type of information comes in.
Yeah, absolutely, Patrick. So, I mean, the Cork merchant princes, of which Thomas Hewitt, who's one of the leading players in the watercourse distillery, would have been one, and there would have been other Cork merchants, merchant princes that we'd be familiar with, Beamish and Crawford and Musgraves and the Barrys and the Loves. But obviously, as their estates were increasing in value, they needed accounting information to determine how exactly they were doing and how they were performing. And from a Cork perspective, there was a Dutchman called Elias Foster, who was said to have established a school in Cork to which a number of the Cork merchants attended. And part of the teaching of the school was bookkeeping and how to keep accounts, and basically to determine if the value of their enterprises were increasing or decreasing. Around the time of the Watercourse Distillery and Thomas Hewitt, it said that, you know, there was the school, a lot of the Cork merchants would have attended, and there was a book written as well, and part of that book, which was written by Foster, was about bookkeeping and how the merchants should conduct bookkeeping.
Very good. And Desmond, it's interesting then the way you look at the role played by brewers in helping the British war effort during the First World War, and McArdle's had a very interesting role there.
That's right, Patrick. Thomas McArdle was later knighted for his work in the war effort and in helping recruitment. But McArdle's described themselves on their letterhead as Irish Army brewers, contractors to His Majesty's forces. So they were, you know, possibly reflecting the prevailing moderate nationalist view at the time. And they supplied ale to the British Army in Liverpool and in the Mediterranean. So there was a quite big part of their business at that stage. And later, what I was very interested to discover was that to help the war effort, the British government decided to acquire compulsorily the entire liquor trade in Britain and Ireland. And that created a lot of problems because the Irish had stronger beers than the English beers. So the people like John Redmond used his budget speech in the House of Commons to try and make the special case that brewing was more significant in Ireland, more important in Ireland than it would be in England.
And do you think they wanted to take over the trade for their own financial benefit so they could make money from it? Or were they helping out the industry? What was the rationale?
Well, the rationale was it changed. Firstly, in 1915, they were saying that because of absenteeism in the munitions factories due to alcohol overuse, they were going to restrict the supply and production of alcohol. But then that changed. By 1917, they said it was more important to restrict the growth of barley and instead to concentrate on food production to help the war effort. So really was, even though the temperance movement were very strong in Parliament, this was not done primarily as a social measure, it was really an economic measure and to help the war effort. And by 1917, the War Cabinet said, this is such an important part of our war effort during the First World War that the government should be prepared to stand or fall on this measure alone.
Very good. And finally, Martin, a last question. It's a brilliant collection because it brings together expertise from all around the world, not just Ireland and the UK, but Spain and Portugal, Russia, Mexico, Japan. It's a truly global collection. How difficult was it to bring together such expertise?
Quite difficult. We have, 15 chapters? I think I probably asked about 50 people. Some people would be true contacts, but like to collect people willing to contribute to a book from so many different countries is quite a task. It's a lot of convincing.
And was there a mixture of beer, wine and everything else served at the book launch?
Well, we did say if we ever could have had a launch, we would have to have at least one drink from each chapter, but that unfortunately hasn't happened because, as you've said, the people are from many different countries too far away, unfortunately.
Okay, well, well done on everyone for being involved in the collection. It's called Accounting for Alcohol, An Accounting History of Brewing, Distilling and Viniculture. The editors, Martin Quinn and João Oliveira, published in hardback by Routledge. And thanks a million for joining me tonight.
Thank you, Patrick.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.